Public health officials are pushing for widespread testing for COVID-19. The CDC says supplies of tests are increasing, but people could still find it difficult to get tested. Right now, the process often involves a long cotton swab stuck deep through the nose to pull a sample. But what if we didn't need those materials or chemicals in a lab right away? What if that test came in the form of dogs? We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent, and you're part of this conversation about canines and their potential ability to sniff out the new coronavirus. So what questions do you have about that? 800-642-1234. Have you heard about dogs using their noses to identify people with malaria or cancer? What do you want to know about how that works? We've got the answers here at 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Cynthia Otto is a professor of working dog sciences and sports medicine at the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine. She's director of the Penn Vet Working Dog Center. Dr. Otto, thank you for joining us on the Ideas Network.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Keely. Thanks for having me.
Where does this idea that dogs might be able to detect and sniff out if a person has the new coronavirus come from?
Well, I think it really goes quite far back with recognizing what dogs have been able to do in the medical detection field. Now, probably even 20 years, we've been thinking about that. And the work that we've done in ovarian cancer detection, as well as a little bit in diabetes alert, and then more recently in other types of infection detection, set us up to think that this is something that with our multidisciplinary team, we could really take on.
I mean, how much better are dogs' noses than ours? It can be kind of hard to comprehend.
And it's also hard to compare. I think there's a whole bunch of things about the dog's nose that really sets them up to see the world through their nose. And, you know, specific odors, maybe there are some that we are better at smelling. But in general, I would say that dogs are, you know, 1,000 times better. Maybe some people say 10,000 times better. But I think they just are so much more attuned to interpreting the world through their nose, whereas we're very visual. We rely on our eyes for pretty much all of our interpretation of the world.
So not only is it different when you compare the two, but just the physical difference in the dog's noses from ours with even smell receptors, the way their noses are built and work with their brains is just inherently different?
Absolutely. So dogs have just even the way air moves through their nose and in their nose and out of their nose is facilitating how they deliver odor to the area in their nose where there are all of these receptors that bind to odors. And that area is much more complex. It's much more expansive. All of the genes that they have for the odor receptors, they have more of those. The part of their nose that actually processes odor is much larger than the human. But the great thing about dogs compared to some of the other species who actually may be more acute in their odor detection, things like grizzly bears, is that dogs work with us and they communicate with us. And they are actually able to really give us that information and work together.
We are talking with Dr. Cindy Otto, who is the director of the Working Dog Center at the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Would you be okay with dogs screening people at airports and businesses? What do you think about the idea of using dogs for the new coronavirus screening? And what other diseases or infections do you think we should try to train dogs to detect? 800-642-1234 is a line for you, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Otto, take us through how the research steps work. How do you determine if COVID-19 even has a scent that dogs can detect?
Well, that's a great question, and it's actually the very first research question. And so we anticipate that it'll have an odor, but we need to make sure that the dogs can detect it. We need to know what are the best samples to be working with. And also, we have to take into account the safety. So what we're working with and what we will be working with are samples from people who have COVID-19 and also people who don't. But all of those samples will have any virus inactivated. So we're not going to be working with live virus. And I think that's an important safety factor for the people as well as the dogs working in this area.
And how is it that dogs smell something like a virus? Are they actually picking up on the scent of the virus?
So another great question. We do know that viruses do have their own unique odors based on some research that was done at Auburn University. But we also know that the body responds to different diseases and different infections in different ways. And so it could be that what we're picking up as the signature odor is part of the odor associated with the virus. It could be part of the odor associated with the response to the virus, or a combination of both of those. And I'm guessing it's probably going to be a combination.
All right. We have James from Kimberly now, who's ready to join our conversation. Good morning, James.
Hello. Good morning. Thanks for putting me on. I wanted to know, I'm owner of a full-blooded red-bone coonhound who, you know, if you know coonhounds, red bones are some of the best sniffers out there, and, you know, she can smell things for days and days old. So I was wondering, is this something that you would train a dog to figure this out, or is this something that, like, through your research that you would then any dog would be able to do it, and they would just, like, the owners would just have to kind of pick up on something that their dog was doing? That's what I was wanting to know.
All right. Thanks for the question, James. Dr. Otto, how extensive is training for dogs who are able to sniff out viruses?
Yeah, so the training is actually pretty extensive. And what we know from some of the work that we've done both with ovarian cancer and, again, our colleagues in Auburn have worked on, not every dog has the mental focus in order to do this, because this is difficult work. And so they have to have kind of the right personality. I think that most of our dogs have the equipment to do it. So they have all of the necessary, setup to smell that type of odor, but to really discriminate. So to pick this needle out of a haystack, they really have to have a little bit more of a focus and that deep attention to detail that, you know, some of our dogs have and some of them don't. And so it's kind of a unique personality opportunity. And it's a lot like us in jobs. I would never be a good CPA, so it's kind of that picking that right dog.
Just not the right fit. James, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. But James does mention coonhounds. You're actually using Labrador Retrievers for this research. Why this kind of dog?
So the reason that we're choosing Labrador Retrievers is really twofold. One, there are enough Labrador Retrievers that we were able to recruit 8 dogs into the program and really start this up, because we wanted dogs that had not been trained on a different odor so that we're really starting with fresh. And we wanted dogs that were at least a year old so that they had some mental maturity. The other reason that we chose Labradors is because eventually we're going to explore whether these dogs can be used to actually sniff people. And so Labradors are a little bit more appealing to the public than, say, a Shepherd, which is great at smelling, but is sometimes a little more intimidating. And that's probably our biggest reason, is the availability and then just the potential application in a public environment.
Dr. Cindy Otto stays with us. She is a professor of working dog sciences and sports medicine at the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine. And we're talking about this idea that there's potential that dogs could be trained to detect the new coronavirus infections. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about that potential for dogs? Have you heard about them being able to detect different kinds of diseases? And how would you feel if there were dogs sniffing and screening people at airports or businesses? There's a line for you at 800-642-1234 to share your thoughts, ask your questions. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Our conversation continues here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and you're listening to The Ideas Network. Furiously to find ways to identify, treat, and prevent COVID-19. The new virus is tricky. It lurks in the body without bringing on any symptoms for days, and we don't know who will have mild symptoms and who will get gravely ill. bring in the dogs. We're talking about whether dogs could be a key for early detection of the new coronavirus. And we're taking your calls. What questions do you have about this potential? Do you worry about whether your pets or working dogs could contract COVID-19? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. We have Dr. Cindy Otto as our guide here. She's the director of the Penn Vet Working Dog Center. And Ruth from Rice Lake is ready to talk with us. Hi, Ruth. Hi, Ruth. You might have your radio on. It's hard for us to hear you, and there's a bit of a delay. What is your question, or what did you want to talk about in this conversation?
Well, I'd like to make a couple of points. I personally would not want a dog testing me for any disease because it's not a proven medical test.
Okay.
I've got family members that work for the Mayo system, and they are medical lab technicians with a bachelor's degree, and I would much rather have solid proof than having an animal. Plus, what if somebody is allergic to a dog? They're afraid of the dog, or the dog becomes aggressive toward a person.
Yeah, Ruth, thank you so much for bringing up those questions. Dr. Otto, what about what Ruth is concerned about when it would be potential for dogs participating in sort of screenings?
I think that's a really great point, and it really is going to influence how we would use these dogs. What we anticipate is that the dogs would be a first-line screen, and they're not a definitive test. And so what they would do is they would identify people who then should have a definitive test. And so that might be really helpful when we have a lot of people who need to be screened. As far as the concern about fear of dogs and allergies to dogs, absolutely. I think it would not be a mandatory screening. It couldn't be. So it's an option. But it's like what happens at the airports. So there are definitely dogs there that are going to be screening people. If people want to opt out of that, then they do have that option. And as far as aggression, that's the whole point of picking the right dogs for this type of work and having to spend the time to train these dogs so that they are comfortable in this kind of environment. Because it's a tough environment. It's a lot of stimulation for the dog. So we definitely need to pick the right personalities.
Right. Because if this were to work, if dogs can do this and handle it and you would deploy dogs, are we talking about things like airports, businesses, even sporting events?
I think that the deployment aspect is a huge open question. One of our big challenges is even at airports, we don't have enough dogs that are trained to do the explosive detection. And so ideally, you can imagine that every place has a dog screening for this, but we just wouldn't be able to have that many dogs trained to the proper standards and making sure that they're safe and we're safe and, everybody's safe involved with this. So it's going to be a slow buildup, and it's really hard to predict where those first screening opportunities will be if we can actually show that the dogs can do that in that kind of an environment.
Yeah,
and
we
do
have
it safely.
Certainly. We have a listener who sent a question regarding what signal a dog would make if they found someone who has COVID-19. What kind of signal? How would you know that the dog had detected it?
That's really a great question as well. And a lot of times in our training, we use their natural response to a trained odor, and that's oftentimes a stand and a freeze, almost like a bird dog would point at a bird. But we could also train them to lie down. We could train them to sit. If you've ever been to the airport with the beagles and they sit by your bag, you know that you've just been called out, that you have some sort of produce in your bag.
Yeah, there is. It's a definite obvious thing. So that is certainly something to think about if we, get through all of these trials and start seeing dogs doing this in real life. We are talking with Dr. Cindy Otto, who is the director of the Penn Vet Working Dog Center, about the potential for dogs as a testing or a screening technique when it comes to COVID-19 infections. And we do have time for your call at 800-642-1234 as we are talking about this. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. And Jane from Appleton is ready to join the conversation. Hey, Jane.
Hi there. I just wanted to make a comment about the Labrador Retriever as a potential dog for detecting coronavirus. My daughter has disabilities, and she's had a service dog who's a Labrador Retriever for 5 years now. and she formerly had golden retrievers, two of them over the past 20 years. And a Labrador retriever is a highly ambitious and eager to learn breed. And when the right treats, you can almost train it to do anything quickly and reliably. And also, it's a very eager to please and affectionate dog, so I don't think it would create a barrier for fear. And I think it's a great idea to start with as far as using an animal, because obviously we know their senses are much more developed than humans.
Interesting. Thanks, Jane. So, Dr. Otto, it sounds like you've got another vote for the labs that you're working with now.
That's great.
You know, are other people working on this kind of research or on similar projects? Is this gaining some traction?
Absolutely. There are a number of people all over the world, and we're actually working to build an international consortium of people who are working in this area, particularly those people who are employing, you know, the highest standards of science and animal welfare and really looking out for the safety involved in this. And I think that's really important when we're looking at this. A lot of people are excited about being involved in something like this, but we really don't want to jump in without taking into account all of the pieces to make this the safest and most successful and scientifically sound approach.
Are all researchers who are looking at using dogs thinking of deploying them in the same way, or are there kind of different goals when it comes to this research with canines?
Yeah, there's probably three major goals that we have when we're thinking about looking at the canines. The first goal is our proof of concept. So is there an odor? And what that goal helps us is it helps us give credence to individuals who might be looking at a new technique for screening using the chemical signature of the odor or an electronic nose, an electronic sensing device. So that's step one, using the dogs just to help us advance other technology, which is what we're doing with ovarian cancer. The second step is that operational deployment of screening people at various in various environments, and that there's so many different approaches to that or applications. And then probably the last and least common at this point is screening the environment. So screening for contaminated locations or surfaces. And so that's kind of the third option that we would consider these dogs for.
All right. And it sounds like we have another question when it comes to breeds. We have some callers who know a lot about different kinds of dogs. We want to welcome Mo from Oconto now. Hi, Mo.
Hi, ladies. My question is actually twofold. One is the Clumber Spaniel. They're a rare breed, but they're a hunting dog breed, and they're said to have one of the best noses out there. So I don't know if that has been checked into or just maybe a hint there. And the second thing is, can they be trained to find more than one issue or disease? And does that training lose effectiveness like an old athlete? Thank you.
All right, Mo. Dr. Otto, what do you think there?
Great. I am familiar with Clumber Spaniels. Part of the problem is that there's not very many of them available out there. And so that would be a challenge for us to consider, you know, revving up a program with Clumber Spaniels. But we're always open to any of the breeds that can do the work, especially if their personality and their physical structure allows them to do the work. And then the second question was, remind me.
He was just, Mo was wondering about whether this ability kind of degrades as a dog ages.
Well, so, yeah, I guess the question is, can they detect more than one thing?
Yep.
And I think that's actually really an interesting question, because people have asked, well, we have all these bomb dogs. Can they also detect COVID? And technically, yes, they could be trained. But in practice, it would be a really bad idea, because if they alerted, we don't know if that person has a disease or a bomb. Uh-huh. So, you know, that's a very clear thing. If we wanted to train them on COVID and then maybe a new pandemic came along, yes, they could be trained on that second disease as well. We know that drug dogs are trained on, you know, many, many different kinds of drugs. Bomb dogs are trained on many, many different kinds of explosives. So they can learn all of that. And then with aging, do they get worse in their performance? And we don't have much science to support that. It seems like
that their noses keep working. Sometimes they lose the motivation to keep working, or maybe they have physical issues that prevent them from doing their jobs. But that is a wonderful research question that we'd love to answer.
All right. Dr. Otto, we really appreciate your time today. Thanks for helping us understand your research.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Cynthia Otto is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine, where she's also the director of the Working Dog Center. And we've been talking about the potential for dogs to be able to sniff out and identify infections from the new coronavirus. Up next is news. Then we are talking with a researcher from the Wisconsin Policy Forum about the new coronavirus pandemic and how it's affecting state government, especially school budgets. Spoiler alert, it's not good. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us here on The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about the pandemic's toll on government and school coffers. State tax collections are down $313 million from last year. That's according to estimates released yesterday by the nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau. And last week, Governor Tony Evers' administration ordered state agencies to cut spending by 5%. Still, a new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum shows schools could likely face cuts down the road. What do you think? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. How is your budget being affected by the pandemic? What are your top concerns as government leaders look at the financial challenges facing them? Where are your priorities? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is Jason Stein. He's research director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Jason, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Keely.
How surprised should we be by yesterday's new tax collection estimates from the Fiscal Bureau?
I think, you know, we were certainly expecting a very big impact. When you look at the number for just April, April 2020 was down $870 million from April 2019, which is a really terrifying number. You know, one silver lining is that the state has delayed the income tax filing and quarterly payment deadlines. And that means that some portion of that we will make up in the coming months as people file and pay their quarterly taxes later, but we don't know how much of that we'll make up yet. And it really matters when we get those final numbers.
Do we have any more clarity, though, about how the pandemic then could affect these state budgets, municipal budgets, school budgets?
Sure. So, I mean, clearly there are going to be big impacts. I don't think there's a scenario where we don't have big impacts. It's just a question of, is it big or is it very big? As the state faces challenges, schools and local governments, you know, particularly schools, you know, have challenges themselves because the state's largest single expense is K-12 school aids in 2019, roughly $6 billion or about a third of the budget in the state's main account or fund. So it would be very difficult if the state has a budget repair bill or if the state has got to adjust its spending downward to balance its budget for lawmakers and the governors to hold schools harmless. And that's one of the reasons why it's very difficult for school officials to budget right now, because they're doing it under a real cloud of uncertainty about what's going to be happening with their finances. And we can talk more about that.
Yeah, because certainly there's money that comes from the state, but how much do schools rely on that funding versus local property taxes or other sources?
Sure. It's very important, state aid as a share of school district budgets. You know, I mean, it varies in how you think about it, but certainly, you know, if you look at it, we're about, you know, more than half of their revenues come from the state. And, you know, that's more than other local governments in Wisconsin. And, you know, depending on the source of data you use, more than other school districts nationally, or at least as much. So, you know, there's reason to think that schools could be hit particularly hard by state budget troubles. And then it really varies by individual school district. So general school aids in our state are allocated by property tax values. So, you know, rural districts or districts like the Milwaukee Public Schools or Beloit, they have lower property values in many cases and receive more state aid. School districts like Madison and suburban Milwaukee schools have higher property values and receive less state aid. So, you know, a cut to state aid may not affect districts evenly across the board. It's going to hit some districts potentially harder than others. There's some caveats to that, but I think, you know, as a general rule, that's something to remember.
And also, it sounds like in general, what you're saying is that schools in poorer communities might be more vulnerable to state cuts.
I think that's potentially true, yes. And, you know, those would be some of the same communities where you would have more underserved students, you know, more students of color, more students in poverty that may have, you know, challenges in the learning environment to begin with. So, you know, I think that's another thing to keep in mind as we go through this crisis.
Not only are schools grappling with making sure that this budget is shored up and looking forward and going, how much money are we even going to have to pay teachers to spend on students? They've also encountered unexpected costs because of the pandemic that are really putting some financial pressure on them. What has come up that schools have had to spend money on that they didn't intend to if we'd, you know, had kids in classrooms?
Right. I think that's a good point. You could imagine a garden variety economic crisis or recession, right, where state tax revenues are taking a hit. Schools might expect financial problems on the revenue side. You know, they might have some additional spending, but their operations would continue, you know, in something like, quote unquote, normal fashion. You know, that is not the case right now. So you see districts obviously around the state, they've had to end classroom instruction and shift to virtual learning. You know, that has meant many districts have made investments in computers, software licenses, training, you know, in some cases, copying or shipping costs to get materials to students. And, you know, we don't fully know yet when they will return to normal in that range. You know, summer school might be affected. And when you look to the fall, you know, even if regular instruction, classroom instruction returns, there might still be some types, I'm not a public health expert, but there might still be some types of restrictions in terms of how many students can be on a school bus or in a classroom, or how you can serve school lunch that might affect, you know, not just the district's operations, but their finances as well.
We're discussing what the pandemic could mean for the budgets of state and local governments and school services. Our guest is Jason Stein from the Wisconsin Policy Forum. And there's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Do you work at a school or for a government office in Wisconsin? How is your budget being affected by the pandemic? Maybe you don't. What are your top concerns at the state level or the city level? What are you looking at for schools and trying to figure out what would be a priority? And what services do you think might endure some cuts and should endure some cuts? And what do you think we have to preserve? 800-642-1234 is a line for you to share your ideas. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jason, what about emergency funds? What does your reporting show about how much money schools have in reserves that could help them weather this crisis?
Well, during the economic expansion, schools did add to what we refer to as their fund balances, their reserves. And that represents the assets minus the liabilities that the schools have. And we looked at the funds used for instruction. And so, you know, in many cases, this is cash, but it doesn't have to be. It could be receivables. It could be money in property tax payments or state aid that is due to districts and they don't actually have in hand yet. You know, it could be as well amounts that can be restricted. So they might, you know, in certain cases be gifts or donations or types of money that they can't simply use to pay teachers' salaries. So you have to be careful about how you characterize it. But schools have added to their reserves in recent years as a whole, when you look at it statewide. And, you know, that's better than if they had not. It at least gives them a little more in the way of resources that they can try and use to respond to this challenge. Although, again, as a one-time source of money, a fund balance can't necessarily make up for a permanent decrease in revenue or increase in spending.
How quickly do schools have to make these major budget decisions, like staffing? I mean, because that could affect even class sizes in the fall.
Right. I mean, it varies. So they've already had to, you know, enter into the hiring and contracting process with teachers. They're already moving ahead with their preliminary budgets for the 2021 school year that starts in July. So they're already moving forward with that. You know, it is normal that school districts will come in the fall and revise their preliminary budget and finalize their property tax levy. You know, in many cases, the revisions that get done in the fall can be pretty minor. This year, they could certainly be much more significant. And that's something the public should be aware of, because there's so much that we don't know right now. If the state comes in and changes school aids, and also, you know, the state, it's possible that the state could change the caps that it puts on school district revenues from general school aids and property taxes. And if the state were to do that, every district would be affected. So not just the districts that depend heavily on state aid, but also the districts that rely more on local property taxes.
So it's individual school districts having to grapple with this, but all affected in some way, somehow.
At least potentially, yes.
All right. We are talking with Jason Stein, who is with the Wisconsin Policy Forum, and we're discussing how the pandemic's toll is happening on government and school coffers, what's happening with school district funding right now. And there's time for your questions at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about how government is pivoting as we look at changes to revenues? What do you want to understand about how the process works and where the money comes from, where it goes? And how would you handle cuts if you had to deal with it right now? What areas of state government do you think we could pull back from? And where are your non-negotiables, the things that are absolute priorities for you right now when it comes to funding from the state, from cities, from schools? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings or send your question or your ideas via email, and that is at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue this conversation here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. More than 500,000 people have filed unemployment claims in Wisconsin since this new coronavirus pandemic caused an economic shutdown in mid-March. And aside from the increased cost of paying those claims, the surge in people out of work is causing a slump in income tax collections. People aren't spending as much money. We're discussing the role growing financial pressure of government offices and schools and possible budget cuts ahead. Jason Stein from the Wisconsin Policy Forum stays with us, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. How has the pandemic affected the taxes that you pay? What are your top priorities as government and school leaders consider cuts? Join in at 800-642-1234. And we've got John from Thorpe who wants to help us better understand the circumstances. Hi, John. Thanks for the call.
Hey, good morning. I wanted to say that although school districts appear to have a fund balance, it's not typically money sitting in the bank. In my district, for instance, we try to carry a fund balance so that we don't have to go out and borrow money to make payroll, especially in December. we don't get a monthly allocation of funds from the state or from the county in terms of our property taxes or state aids. We get money at certain times of the year, and so we'll get quite a bit of our annual funding comes in January, but in December, we may even have to go to the bank and borrow money to be able to have enough to make payroll. So although we show a fund balance, it's not a significant amount of money, and it's not an amount of money that's sitting in the bank that we can just use up to make it through this crisis.
So, John, it's not just a sort of, I guess, to compare it to personal finances. It's not just a savings account that sits there. It's something that you dip into and that you actively manage.
Yeah, of sorts. And it represents the difference between the amount of income we have in a year and the amount of expenditures we have in a year. And so over the course of the year, there is a difference. But at different times, we have more in the bank, and other times we have a lot less in the bank. And in fact, last year, we had to go to the bank to borrow money so that we didn't run out in order to make a payroll in December.
John, you have you are quite well versed in this. You have a role in a school district where you are?
Yeah, I'm the superintendent in Thorne, which is a small district of Carroll Clare.
And do you have any idea where you would start if you had to make cuts?
Well, you know, it starts now about being very judicious with hiring. Your guest talked about getting people under contract, and we are needing to replace some retirements, but we're trying to be very judicious about the ongoing hiring. The other thing then we would start to look at is what can we do around student supports. But as your guests also mentioned, the idea of having lower class sizes, that just causes us to need more staff, not less. So it's going to be a real challenge. And we're budgeting for the possibility of either no change in state aid or a significant reduction in state aid. And I'll have a draft budget to my board here in a couple of weeks for next year based on a variety of different possibilities.
Wow. John, thank you so much for being willing to share what's going on in your district as we try to work through this. Jason Stein, in April, more than 80% of school referendums passed on that ballot. That's more than $1.7 billion in funding. Could those referendums help stabilize school funding during this pandemic?
Potentially, yes. I mean, it's certainly, I think probably for those districts, you would rather pass those referendum than not pass them. You know, one challenge for districts will be with their communities. You know, a referendum gives a district the authority to raise property taxes, you know, to either cover its operating budget or, you know, a capital project like renovations at a school. But school boards will still have to make a determination about whether, given all the challenges that many communities are facing, whether they can raise property taxes or raise them to the full amount that they otherwise might have. And just to respond to something that John said, I think he makes a good point about the fact that, you know, many districts do need to do short-term borrowing each year. The State Association of School Business Officials has put that number at about 160 out of the state's 421 districts. And if districts had to draw down their fund balances, you would see that number of districts increase, and there would be a cost to the districts for that.
All right. Certainly a complicated issue that affects a lot of people. We are talking with Jason Stein of the Wisconsin Policy Forum about how the pandemic is affecting budgets. We've been talking a lot about schools, also talking about state government and how different communities will be handling this. And we are taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Scott in New Berlin is on the line now. Hi, Scott.
Yes, hello. I've been harping on this point, but I can't get a hold of anybody in state government for a month. There should be a 20% across-the-board pay cut for every government employee until we're out of this mess. And across the board, everyone, from state to county to schools, everything, because everybody else's hours are getting cut here and there, and I haven't seen the state take hardly anything to account for the reduction in revenues. I've heard Governor Evers, something about 5%. That's a pittance. And then the UW system, one furlough day per month for the next 6 months. That's nothing. 20% across the board to every state and government employee. And then maybe there'll be a little more pressure to open the economy back up.
All right, Scott, we hear you loud and clear. Jason, Scott says the cuts that we've made are a pittance. Is that what 5% across the board looks like in state government or with the UW system?
It's certainly true that you do see some local governments already doing furloughs. You've seen the city of Milwaukee talk about that. You know, at many other places, you haven't seen furloughs yet, but you have already seen hiring freezes. We'll see what happens over the next year. I mean, it certainly seems like the impacts will be very severe and deep, both at the local and the state level. One thing that we don't know yet is what the federal government will do in response. So there was a very large, the CARES Act response passed at the federal level. It provides a lot of money to the state. So far, the guidance has suggested that that money can't be used to offset lost revenues. You know, it's possible that the federal government could either change that guidance or provide a larger or provide some other aid package in the future. And that might change the situation substantially for the state. You know, if that doesn't happen, you're probably looking at significant cuts. If everything holds true the way it appears to right now, but there's still a lot of unknowns.
What do we know about how this pandemic and the economic circumstances could affect funding sources for cities that rely on things like police or firefighters, trash disposal?
I mean, I think they would have the same concerns that the state does in that, you know, the state has what's called shared revenues for cities and counties and villages around the state. That's in the neighborhood of $800 million. In addition, there's local road aids that local governments receive. Those are funded in part through the state gas tax. With everyone sheltering in place, you know, we've presented research that shows that there's been very significant fall off in driving around the state. That's going to affect gas tax revenues and local road aids. So, you know, other local governments, although they don't depend on state aid to the degree that school districts do, it's still a very important part of their budget, and they could see hits as well.
All right, Jason, we know we're at the beginning of this conversation. Thank you for breaking it down for us where we stand now.
Oh, thank you, Keely.
Jason Stein is research director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum, and we've been talking about the pandemic's financial toll on government services and a lot about the fact that schools are going to have to start making decisions with what is either flat or maybe even cuts for school districts, for staff, for per student allocations. Up next here on The Morning Show, we're learning about how musicians are handling cancellations of concerts and festivals. They're taking the hit financially and creatively. Join the conversation. Email ideas at WPR.org. Are you a musician or a fan? What's the hardest part about live music being on hiatus? And how do you think local music will be different as the COVID-19 outbreak wanes? We've got a panel of musicians from across the state ready to share their stories with you. I'm Keely Boltina. This is the Ideas Network.